You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Probably the greatest popularized leader was Julius Caesar. What really upset the Senate oligarchs was not Caesar's accumulation of power, but how he used the power. He attempted to deal with unemployment, he attempted to deal with poverty, he attempted to deal with unfair taxes, he attempted to deal with debt relief, land redistribution, and aristocratic greed. And those were unforgivable things. A ruling class will forgive anything except if you just tiptoe on their interests and smudge the edge of their interests one bit. That's what they don't forgive.
That's Michael Parenti, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Michael Parenti on class struggle from Roman times to today. A constant throughout history, from ancient Rome to the present, is the rich and powerful seek ever more wealth and control. If a popular leader comes along and innovates reforms that help the poor, they come under sustained attack, or worse, they are killed. Go back to Caesar in Rome. The standard view is he was a power-hungry tyrant who was slain by the noble Brutus and his cohorts to save the Roman Republic. These were some of the measures Caesar implemented, which so infuriated his enemies. He distributed land to thousands of veterans and poor Roman families. He began a program of public works. He pushed through rent reductions, reduced debt burdens, and granted Jews the right to practice their religion. These reforms, Michael Parenti says, were unacceptable to the ruling class. Thus Caesar was assassinated on the Ides of March, 44 BC. To talk about class struggle from Roman times to today is Michael Parenti. He's a leading independent political analyst and scholar. Cornel West calls him a towering prophetic voice. He's the author of many books, including Democracy for the Few, Against Empire, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. This classic was recorded in Seattle in 2008. And now, Michael Parenti.
I want to say something about history first, because our images of the past are created largely by history's winners. The voices of the losers are muted, or if they come to us, they're through very carefully tuned filters. The struggle to lay claim to the labor, the land, and the wealth of society, which is so much the motive force of history, that struggle is called class struggle. And it carries over into the writing of history itself. The writing of history has long been a privileged calling undertaken within the church, the royal court, the affluent townhouse, the government agency, the university, and the corporate-funded foundation. The powers that be not only try to control events, but they try to control our memory and understanding of these events, which is part of controlling the events themselves. The social context in which history is written greatly influences the commodity that's produced and distributed. Edward Gibbon, author of that monumental work, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, back in the late 18th century, was himself perfectly aware of the class realities behind the writing of history. He talked about how history had to be written by gentlemen. Isn't that interesting? Gentlemen who had the means, the leisure, to pursue such a calling. In his words, wretched would be the work of those whose scholarly efforts, whose daily efforts, are stimulated by daily hunger. Gibbon himself produced what I would call gentleman's history, a genre heavily imbued with an upper-class ideological perspective. Antiquity, all through antiquity, going back to those early times, gives us numerous gentlemen historians. with a ruling class or upper class perspective and prejudice. Homer, Herodotus, Thucydides, Polybius, Cicero, Livy, Plutarch, Suetonius, Appian, Josephus, Tacitus, those are the ones I've read, almost all of whom had a rather low opinion of the common people. Maybe Plutarch is an exception. I will partially exempt him. He sometimes is capable of a halfway sensitive comment about them. One eminent 20th century British historian, Cyril Robinson, offers the familiar and fanciful notion of an empire achieved stochastically. Stochasticism is the theory that all things happen by chance, without deliberate intent by the actors above, without conscious design. I quote Robinson, "It was perhaps almost as true of Rome as of Great Britain that she acquired her world domination in a fit of absence of mind." Yeah, right. Again, a fairy tale image. An imperialism without imperialists. Isn't that remarkable? Oh, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? You think they actually built this empire? Planned and went out and did things and calculated and raised armies and decided that was a profitable area to conquer? You think they actually thought about that? It was absent-minded. It just kind of, they got up and said, let's see, who are we going to fight today? What are we going to do today? And that theme, by the way, is very familiar to us. We hear that the United States, for half a century, I have heard the United States was thrusted onto the world arena, reluctantly had to assume the role of world leader to meet the challenges of the 20th century. We're never told who did the thrusting, for whose interests, at what cost to the people at home and abroad, nor why it still remains such an imperative, even without the bugaboo of world communist conspiracy to use as an excuse. Along with his class bias, the gentleman historian is likely to be a male supremacist. Surprised? Anybody surprised there? In recent decades, by the way, there's been an emergence of some feminist scholarship, and the study of Roman women has improved somewhat. Some gentleman historians let slip a noticeable ethnic bigotry or ethno-class bigotry. Cyril Robinson asserts that, quote, "the purity of Roman blood began to be contaminated by proletarians of Greek and Oriental origin, persons of feeble character, incapable of assimilating the national habits of decency and restraint, although not all Greeks, of course, were vicious or unwholesome characters." It's always nice when the bigot tries to smuggle in his bigotry under a balanced kind of statement, moderated, qualified, you know. "Some of my best friends," right, "are feeble and incapable characters." It gets better, or I should say worse. Jerome Carcopino, another eminent classicist, writes that interbreeding between Roman aristocrats and their female slaves or freedwomen created a hybridization similar to that which has more recently contaminated other slave-owning peoples. It strongly accentuated the national and social decomposition of Rome. Unquote. No segregationist or Nazi blood theorist could have said it better. These are all the reputable historians. The progenitor of all gentlemen historians of the late Republic, the fount, the source of all gentleman history of the late Republic, who himself was a major participant, Cicero, who has been worshipped by professors and Latin teachers throughout the ages. Cicero railed against the Greeks and Jews who rallied to the side of the democratic leaders. "Impoverished individuals, they often throw our assemblies into confusion. The Greeks are given to shameless lying, the Jews to barbaric superstition. You know how they stick together, how influential they are in informal assemblies." Unquote. Does any of that have a familiar ring to it? While Republican form, how democratic was the late Republic in actual social content? At the very bottom of the social order was a large slave population. About one-third of the entire population was slaves, many of whom were worked to death in the mines and on the plantations, or latifundia, as they were called. On the next rung was the great mass of free Romans, the proletariat, many of them ex-slaves or the descendants of slaves, who lived at the barest subsistence level in the impoverished towns of Italy. Or they lived crowded into thousands of poorly ventilated, disease-ridden tenements within Rome. A rung above the propertyless proletarians were the farmers and small landholders around the outskirts of the city and beyond. A step above them was the small middle class of minor officials, merchants, and light industry employers. And now looming above this multitude was a few thousand multimillionaires, the class known as equites or equestrians, because their property historically qualified them to serve in the cavalry, in the elite corps. Although by the late Republic, most of them had probably never even been on a horse. The equestrians were state contractors, bankers, traders, tax collectors, and landowners. At the very apex of the social pyramid were the wealthy landed aristocrats who populated the Roman Senate, who also invested in business and speculation and banking along with the equestrians, but who had vast lands and who lived in obscene luxury and ostentation. The difference between the equestrians and the aristocracy was really more one of lineage than of wealth. They were absentee owners of vast latifundia, which were worked by huge slave populations, and they did little, very little for the land except work it with slave labor and exploit it, squeeze it for profits. They themselves lived on vast estates. Even Cicero, who was not maybe the very richest among them, owned more than 8 villas along with numerous inner city tenements. By the way, very few present day historians of ancient Rome mentioned the fact that Cicero was a slumlord who bragged about how profitable his tenements were. The aristocracy grew still richer by usurping the ega publicus. This was an event that took place, a process that took place, say, in the 3rd century BC right up to the 2nd century BC. In this process, there was these vast, fertile, state-owned lands outside of Rome that for centuries before, for generations, had been farmed by farming collectives, small farming collectives of independent free labor farmers, and they fed the entire city of Rome. And during times of war, when the small farmers were away in the army and the farms couldn't be kept up, the aristocrats bought them up at bargain prices, or they used, increasingly what started happening toward the 2nd century, they would use hired thugs to go in and drive the families off the public land and replace them with slave labor. This process of agrarian displacement, by the way, continues to this day in many parts of the world, including the United States itself. It reinforces the thesis that I've presented in Dirty Truths, which is that wealth creates poverty. We always don't think of it that way. They think of it as a distribution problem, but in fact it's an interrelational, it's a dynamic there. Rome was a republic more in form than content. By the way, nor was the form all that democratic. Almost all major political decisions were taken by the Senate, an aristocratic, non-elective oligarchy, numbering about 600, all men of wealth. The Senate determined foreign policy, appointed provincial governors, and controlled the purse strings of the Republic. The Senate controlled the deployment of army units and the appointment of top military commanders. The Senate was elected by nobody. It was an oligarchy, self-appointed, self-selecting. This elite group in the Senate, by the middle of the 2nd century, by the time of Tiberius Gracchus, it divided into two groups, the larger one being the optimates, literally the best men, as they modestly called themselves. They were the conservatives devoted to expanding the political economic privileges of the rich and the well-born. The smaller faction in the Senate of this elite group were called populares, and they were reformers with democratic tendencies who sometimes sided with the common people against the Senate itself. Modern-day historians are perfectly aware, by the way, that the Senate enjoyed a near monopoly of power, undemocratic power, and yet they're filled with praise for these oligarchs, describing them. I'll give you a composite of quotes here. Bred to a strong tradition of cautious sanity and self-restraint, stout-hearted, level-headed and patriotic. Historians look very kindly on this republic for the few. For them, senatorial plutocracy is more acceptable and less threatening than proletarian egalitarianism. They embrace Cicero, a self-enriching slaveholder, slumlord, ruling class mouthpiece, executioner, and senatorial oligarch. They embrace Cicero as a champion of liberty who opposed Julius Caesar and who refused to live under a tyranny. And when I say they, I mean really about 95% of all present-day historians of ancient Rome are Cicero supporters. Only a handful are sympathetic to the populares and the Democrats. What does that say about our educational systems and our universities? Cicero, that great champion of Republican liberty, deplored such things as the secret ballot. He said, the secret ballot makes it easier for the common people to act independently and do mischief. A year after Caesar was murdered in 44 BC, Cicero, who was, by the way, not among the assassins, but fully applauded the deed, fully supported it, he wrote to Brutus and to other associates, calling for a ruthless bloodletting, a final solution against the Democrats. I do not admit any doctrine of mercy. There should be a salutary severity, for if we are going to be merciful, civil wars will never cease. We need extreme measures, unquote. One is reminded of Cicero's own role as consul 20 years earlier in 63 BC, when he whipped up an anti-subversion witch-hunting campaign against reformers in the Senate, and then ordered without trial the summary execution of five people he charged with conspiracy against the state. It's called the Catiline Conspiracy. On the basis, by the way, of very dubious and trumped-up evidence. Few modern-day historians pass severe judgment on this atrocity. H.H. Scullard, a leading classicist, sets the tone by allowing that Cicero may have been, quote, overhasty. But he had good reason to feel he had done his duty. Indeed, he had saved his country, unquote. Behind this willingness, ladies and gentlemen, to repress popular forces is a chronic fear of the democratic excesses of the people. I'm not talking about Cicero, I'm talking about Scullard and his associates. We can understand Cicero, he's an aristocrat and all that. But there's that same fear of democratic excesses. There is fear of the people mobilizing and agitating. They need to be curbed by upper-class men of moderation and probity. Upper-class moderation and probity are ingredients, I would suggest, that exist more in the minds of gentlemen historians than in actual history. Nothing said about who curbs those at the top, those who actually have the actual power and are continually abusing it. The best-known and probably the greatest populares leader was Julius Caesar. Although thanks to the way history is retailed, few of us know of him in this role. Here are some of the things Caesar did. Once in power as consul, he founded new settlements for veterans of his army and for 80,000 of Rome's proletarians. He distributed some of the best lands near Rome and elsewhere to 20,000 poor families that had three or more children. Caesar sent many unemployed proletarians to repair ancient cities in the colonies, or he slated them for employment on public works within Rome. He directed large landholders to have at least one-third of their laborers to be freemen, rather than slaves. So every latifundia owner had to have one-third of his workforce had to be free labor rather than slave labor. And this was a rule that would compel payment of wages and thereby somewhat diminish the landowner's high accumulation rate, and it would also reduce unemployment and crime. In an attempt to secure affordable housing for poor tenants, Caesar remitted a whole year of rent for low to moderate dwellings. Following Gaius Gracchus and other populares, Caesar increased duties on luxury imports. First, that was to encourage Italian domestic industry, and second, to make the rich pay something pay something to the state for the obscenely lavish lifestyles they were enjoying. Caesar attempted to impose honest administration in the provinces, where subject peoples were prey to rapacious governors and visiting senators. He saved some of the provincials from the pitiless tax collectors. He capped the tax rates. He fixed the tax rates. and he eliminated the self-enriching middlemen. He ejected from the Senate all those associated with provincial plunder. He eased the desperate burden of a vast debtor class by allowing repayment of debts at lower pre-war prices. He abolished the fines that were put on debtors when they couldn't meet their payments. He ordered that all the interest people had already paid was to be applied to reducing the principal they owed. Oh, if only we could get banks to do that today. He canceled all debt interest that had accumulated over several years. This last measure alone, Suetonius estimates, erased one quarter of all debts, a serious loss for rich creditors. Caesar's efforts at easing the debt burden was designed to help not the profligate few, but the laboring masses. Cicero, for whom such reforms were tantamount to subversion and revolution, voices the fears of many of his class. Quote, "I foresee a bloodbath, an onslaught on private property, the return of exiles and cancellation of debts." Cicero believed that Caesar would show no mercy in killing off the nobility and plundering the well-to-do. Unquote. In fact, Caesar showed remarkable clemency toward his enemies after the Civil War. In some instances, he spared the lives of those who then participated later on in the plot against his life. A number of historians argue that Caesar's intent was to attain and retain autocratic power. And so we even have that term, Caesarism. Well, actually, while he accumulated power, we should also look at how he used it. Toward what ends? Cui bono? Who benefited? I just gave you plenty of examples. Caesar himself said, quote, "I am sated with power and glory. The important thing is to get things done." One of Caesar's first acts upon becoming consul was to have the proceedings of the Senate and the Assembly published and posted every day, so that make them more accountable to the general public. Also to embarrass the senators if he could. During his first consulship, he regularly disregarded senatorial vetoes. He updated and streamlined the voter registration rolls. After the Civil War, he arranged that half the magistrates be popularly elected and half appointed by himself, thereby completely bypassing the Senate. He decisively terminated Cicero's political witch hunts against the Democrats, driving Cicero into exile and rousing panic within reactionary ranks. As part of his war against the Optimates, he substantially expanded Senate membership, filling its ranks with equestrians, with nobility from Gaul, and if that wasn't enough, he even made senators of a small number of libertini. The libertini were the sons of liberated slaves who had risen to distinction on their own merit. All these appointees, by the way, it goes without saying, were totally snubbed and scorned by the Senate oligarchs and optimates. So it's no surprise that Caesar was supported by the Roman proletariat and accepted by many prosperous upper middle class people and entrepreneurs who were satisfied with his orderly administration. Some of the Democrats in Rome saw a total social revolution, a redistribution of wealth among the poor. Some even thought to free the slaves and extend citizenship to foreign residents. Caesar found their support useful, but he was a reformer, not a social revolutionary. He abolished all workers' guilds, a lot of new guilds were being formed, new worker unions and such. He abolished them, except for the very ancient ones. And he would not go all the way with the Democrats by eliminating all debt payments. And he did accrue extraordinary honors and power to himself. He had himself appointed Imperator of Rome. Imperator has been translated by too many historians to mean dictator. Both Imperator and the other Latin word dictator, which is spelled identically like the English word dictator, Imperator and dictator were akin to commander-in-chief or supreme commander. They usually were appointed for limited six-month terms, although it's doubtful that he would have stayed only 6 months. Plutarch reports that Caesar's predominance caused the Senate and nobility to fear that, quote, he might now urge the people to every kind of insolence, unquote. And the worst insolence was for the people to demand a larger portion of the pie. Caesar was assassinated as he presided over the Senate in March 15, 44 BC, the Ides of March, as it was called on the Roman calendar, by a dozen or so senators. And the story goes, as told by Suetonius, Appian, Plutarch, they're all vivid descriptions of this. He was walking into the Senate. As he walked in, someone handed him a piece of paper saying, "Beware that there's an attack imminent, about to happen," the story goes, and he just put that into a pile of sheets of paper that he had. And when he went in, the very first senator who came up to him with a bill proposal then hit him with a dagger, and the others came around him and got him, and then fell, ironically, right at the base of the statue of Pompeii, which the Senate oligarch insisted on having. Historians who are willing to consider any interest except class interest explain away the assassination in terms that are oddly, unsettlingly favorable to the assassins. So we're told that the conspirators had a strong distaste for dictatorship and refused to accept one-man rule, that they wanted to preserve their beloved republic and its long-standing traditions. Many, like Cicero, supposedly had a profound respect for the law and could not forgive Caesar's usurpation. Cicero was not invited to join with the dagger. You really had these super aristocratic elites. Brutus and Cassius were the two main perpetrators. But, I mean, they were like mine, like Cicero. Others supposedly felt a personal jealousy and rivalry because they were so overshadowed by this truly remarkable man. And by the way, Caesar was a man of outstanding qualities. He was said to have been a commanding and inspiring figure, uncommonly intelligent, handsome, and utterly charming when he cared to be. He was the son of one of Rome's leading aristocratic families. He was a brilliant and fearless military leader who really inspired his troops. He was highly regarded for the quality and clarity of his writing and was considered one of the great prose stylists of his day. He was considered one of Rome's greatest public speakers. He could stir his audience with the force and persuasive clarity of his words. Even a great orator and bitter rival like Cicero was forced to admit that he knew of no more impressive speaker than Julius Caesar. And by the way, this was in an age when public speaking and rhetoric was very, very, very important. Public speaking and rhetoric are lost arts today in public life in this age of TV sound bites and image engineering. Caesar also possessed some less than perfect traits, most notably, like other military commanders of his day, he was a conqueror and plunderer of lands, and he also extorted huge sums from rich kings. I can't get too exercised about that one, actually. What really upset the Senate oligarchs was not Caesar's accumulation of power, but how he used the power. Like other populares before him, he attempted to deal with unemployment, he attempted to deal with poverty, he attempted to deal with unfair taxes, he attempted to deal with debt relief, land redistribution, and aristocratic greed. And those were unforgivable things. A ruling class will forgive anything except if you just tiptoe on their interests and smudge the edge of their interests one bit. That's what they don't forgive. If the aristocrats longed to protect the Constitution, which, by the way, was an unwritten one of custom and practice, it was not out of some abstract commitment to Republican principles. It was because the Constitution fortified their oligarchy. It was their law, their Constitution, it was their republic. And it was made to accommodate their, quote, traditional class interests. Aristocratic freedom is not meant to serve a popular ruler or a democratic constitution. It's meant to serve no ruler except the aristocrats themselves. And when they were talking about freedom, they're talking about their freedom to do what they want unaccountably to any other social groups. Aristocratic freedom is the freedom to maintain one's own enormous class privileges, to enjoy every prerogative of power and wealth without restraint. It was, and it still is to this day, antithetical to popular democracy. Aristocratic freedom continues to be pursued today by corporate elites with their MAI, GATT, and NAFTA, the aristocracy of international global finance, giving them power that is unaccountable to popular sovereignty.
You're listening to Michael Parenti on Class Struggle from Roman Times to Today. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-888-8888.